You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
I'm Jamie Dumont.
And I'm Rob Russo. And this is The Fabulous Invalid.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie.
Well, here we are officially in the full swing of the new year.
Yes. 2019.
It's here.
Happy New Year.
It's queer.
It certainly is. Yeah. I saw the prom last night, so tell me, my year is off to a very queer
start. Very queer start.
2 days after seeing Head Over Heels.
There were a lot of people at the prom last night.
Yeah. Well, it was counter-programming for the president's address, you know?
Oh, yes. Which I watched, but we won't talk about that.
We won't go there. No.
Well, I have big news,
yes.
As you know, Rob Russo, because you are partially responsible, almost entirely responsible. I have finally gotten on Spotify.
Yes.
So I'm very excited about that. I'm still learning my way, and I have to figure out how to close up my Pandora account so that I'm not paying for two.
What is Pandora?
Pandora is something that old people like I myself use. It's a streaming musical service that has commercials on one way that I listen to it and no commercials on another way. I don't know.
Seems like a personal problem.
I have probably two different accounts and whatever. Anyone who knows me knows that this is not my strong suit.
But now you're on Spotify.
I am on Spotify. So the reason I bring all of this up is that if anybody has any advice for me or playlists, I will happily take them. What I want to say is if anyone thinks that they would be interested in our playlists or a Fabulous Invalid playlist, maybe tweet at us or direct message me on something, and we could maybe talk about doing some of that. Because I've already started doing, now I have some Spotify friends, and so I've been sharing things, and I'm getting into it. I still can't figure out half of it, but I'll get there. The week is sort of behind us, I'll probably be texting you a lot saying, how do I do this? How do I do that?
That it could do! I could do that!
Here's what I want to say about the Golden Globes. I'm, one, shocked that you watch the Golden Globes, but like, every time I make a joke about you having a television and you very crossly correct me. But the thing I will say about the Golden Globes, and this is something I have said about the Oscars, and it's something I have said since I saw the film, Glenn Close was not an upset for me the other night when she won for The Wife over Lady Gaga, because as far as I'm concerned, that is her award to lose. She has it. I have not seen The Favorite, although I will say I'm a huge Olivia Colman fan. I feel like I'm the first person in America that knew who she was because I was a huge fan of The Rev, which is a show, I think that's the name of it, that nobody's ever heard of, that she was on, and Broadchurch, and so on and so forth. But my point is, her time will come, but I really, really have always been very full of conviction that this is the time for Glenn Close. What? So her winning the Golden Globe was not an upset to me, and her winning the Academy Award in a few weeks' time will just be an inevitability.
Well, I have to say, it might not have been a surprise to you, but it seemed like it was a genuine surprise to Glenn Close, because her the reaction shot when they announced her name was unbelievable. I mean, she's a good actor, but like that was real. She was not expecting to win that award.
No,
and even if Jamie Dumont sitting in his apartment watching it knew that it was
like,
going to happen.
I was like filing my nails, rolling my eyes, like, going, "Oh, Mary, right? Please." Yeah. No, but do you like how I was? I'm making the filing my nails.
You can't say file your nails gesture. Without actually doing it.
No, I think it was genuine, and I think she probably thought, it's the Golden Globes, how am I going to beat Lady Gaga?
And how many times in her career has she been screwed over by major awards, right? She's never won an Oscar, famously.
No, she wasn't nominated for Reversal of Fortune, which, if you haven't seen it, is one of the most brilliant...
I haven't seen it.
Rob Russo.
I've never heard of that movie. Reversal of Fortune? What year was that?
It shocks me that we've become as close friends as we've become. Reversal of Fortune is one of the greatest pictures ever made about I say that every time, don't I? I say that every single time. It's about Sonny. Do you know who Sonny Von Bülow was?
No.
So Sonny Von Bülow was a Newport socialite with obviously a lot of money, and she married a man named Klaus Von Bülow, who many people, he was a European playboy. Long story short,
love a Klaus.
He was accused of murdering her, or not murdering her, I misspeak. She was sent into an insulin-induced coma from which she never recovered. And she spent the last 30 years of her life as in a vegetative state in a hospital on the Upper East Side. But he was convicted of, not convicted, he was accused of trying to murder her, attempted murder, I suppose. And it was quite a scandalous story in the early 80s, complete with drug dealers and male prostitutes, and not on his, not him, he was straight. but it's a wonderful film with Glenn Close and... oh, I can't think of the man who plays Klaus von Bülow.
Well, I'm Jeremy, not helpful because Jeremy I've never Irons, heard of this movie.
Jeremy Irons, who was nominated for an Academy Award.
Oh, isn't that funny? They did the real thing together on Broadway.
They did. Well, and Christine Baranski plays the
Stop it.
The girlfriend that he ends
How
up with.
How have I never
with.
Heard of this movie?
It's a fabulous movie. It was Alan Dershowitz's first, one of his early big cases, which is played by Ron Silver. Annabella Sciorra has a small part in it. Fisher Stevens has a part in it. Uta Hagen plays the maid, who was manufacturing evidence to convict Klaus. Mm. So this is all based on a Dominic Dunn story for Vanity Fair, I believe the film is. And it's a wonderful film, and there's a scene in it where she's eating ice cream, smoking a cigarette with sunglasses on in a very grand dining room, and that alone should have won her an Academy Award. It is one of the great moments of film.
Okay, well, I'm going to look up this movie.
I know these are big statements. Anyway.
Well, you like to make a big statement.
And I like Glenn Close.
And you like, who doesn't like Glenn Close?
I'd like to. Well, I mean, that's not this
that's
show.
A different podcast.
There is actually a podcast
I think devoted to the subject. I don't doubt
but
that.
Yes, I think if you think you were a breakdown every year, I don't think there's a year where you go, oh yeah, she was robbed. I think she unfortunately made all of her great films in years of other great films. Right. But I suppose you could say that about almost every single year.
Sure. Well, it was a good night for stage actors at the Golden Globes, or you know, actors we love to see in New York.
Well,
Glenn Close first and foremost. I mean, that was huge. I believe Ben Whishaw won an award. Oh. Patricia Clarkson, who's done a lot of stage work.
She has. I love her, too.
Yeah, who doesn't love Patricia Clarkson? Even Darren Criss, right? I mean, that was a big, you know, big career moment for him to win a Golden Globe.
Did you see that for Versace thing?
I did not. I heard it was fantastic.
It is great, and I think it's either on Netflix or Hulu in the next few days. Yeah. I recommend it. It's also, like, the real star of that is... Judith Light.
Judith Light's the star of anything she's in.
She is. She has a few small scenes, but it is
gold.
Doesn't
matter how much material she has. Yeah. She's always the star. Yeah. That's a compliment. I mean, that is a compliment. So it was a good night for some stage actors.
She's the reason I didn't go into acting.
Judith Light.
Mm-hmm. She told me I didn't have the drive.
Wow. Okay.
I was in high school.
Well, we need to get
but
her
that's
on.
That's another story.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, we need to get her on. Forget about the story. It is,
I should qualify that in case this makes it on the air. She did not say it in a malicious way.
It was the
greatest thing somebody ever did. It's actually one of the great things somebody did for me in my life, which was to point out to me that I had a certain amount of talent and I had a certain look and all that other stuff and connections or whatever you want to call it, but that I didn't want it enough.
Yeah.
And nobody had said that to me. And I didn't know her. She was just teaching an acting class I was in high school. And it was one of the great things, and I will forever be grateful to her, and I can't imagine she would... thank you, and if we ever have her on here... You know, I've been with her, I've had dinner with her,
Have you told her?
No, I've never,
the moments just never come.
She was at my table at a wedding years ago, and... because it's just like, changed the course of my life.
In closing, you should see The Favorite.
Oh, I will.
Because Olivia Colman is pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen all the films for this year, but because, you know, the theater schedule is just insane. But The Favorite is my favorite film of the year, and I feel comfortable saying that.
Have you seen The Wife?
I have not seen The Wife. No one's seen The Wife, though. Where? I mean, when did that come out?
Last year. It was in. Well, I saw it in San Francisco, but it was here too. It's a great film. It's a good film. It's not a great film. Yeah. It's a great performance in a very good film.
Yeah. Well, I have to say this is purely based off of internet chatter, but there is a sub stream of commentary that says that the actual, real, greatest film performance of the past year is not even a nominated performance, and that's Toni Collette in Hereditary. Because it's a horror film, people overlook it, but I've seen some clips, and I love me some Toni Collette. So
I've seen the film.
Oh, okay.
I love a horror film.
Yeah.
I love Toni Collette more than I love all the horror films combined.
Yeah.
It is a great performance, and I can see it getting a nomination, although I don't think it will, but I think it's worthy of it. The film takes a twist that you either, at the end, that you either love and go with, or you don't love and don't go with, and I think that might be something that precludes that performance from the serious recognition that it probably should deserve.
Well, I'm always rooting for her.
I love these subgroups you're reading. I think we need a little more information on that. But
well, no, it's just as I scroll through Twitter, you know, you pick up on themes, and that's one that I've seen for a little while now. Every once in a while, someone tweets it, and it's like, yeah, you know, it's true.
As you know, I struggle with Twitter.
Yeah, we all struggle with Twitter.
This is like one of the first years there's no clear front runner.
Yeah,
for Best Picture.
Have you seen all the pictures, Aaron?
I have not. I'm really bad this year.
Do you normally see all the pictures?
I usually see like 75% of them. I try to see a lot. Last year I saw almost all of them and was very disappointed.
What was your favorite picture last year, Aaron?
Last year it was, Call Me By Your Name. But that was not going to win. But it was either that or Three Billboards.
I just rewatched In Bruges. Have you seen In Bruges?
I never have.
Okay. Yeah. Aaron, go home. Stream, tweet, whatever you... No, you don't tweet films. But stream, whatever, however you watch. Watch In Bruges. And then we'll have a conversation about it because it's a great film. But I think on that note, we've rattled on about movies. Every once in a while you have to take a little left turn.
Yes.
Or as Samard would say, as Jennifer would say, a signal a lane change.
Right. Here's a good bridge. During the Golden Globes telecast, there was a teaser trailer for Fosse Verdon, the coming miniseries on FX, which... You know, there you go, from film to stage. Bob Fosse was the perfect figure.
We're going to have to put a pin in this, and we're going to have to talk about this later.
Oh, we need to do it.
Because there's a lot of things I have to say about this, and a lot of things, many people have a lot to say about this trailer, and so I think we need to unpack that next week.
There you go.
Back in December, we had dinner with Rick Ellis at Orso, and Rick is one of those marvelous storytellers and really has had such a phenomenal career, kind of a two-part career, both as an executive at Sereno Coin for many, many years, running ad campaigns for one of the largest advertising agencies on Broadway, but also as a very noted and well-known book writer of musicals and playwright. So we decided to break that interview up into two parts. The first part, we talk primarily about his current show, The Cher Show, which is available on iTunes and is the episode right before this. And today's episode is the second half of that conversation. Enjoy. Well, I want to travel back in time a little bit to a New York that doesn't exist anymore, and that would be 1982.
Oh my God!
Which I think was a pretty good year for you. It was not only the year you met Roger, but it was also the year you started at Sereno Coin.
Yes, actually, those two things happened within a month of each other.
Oh wow!
So tell me a little bit about New York and the theater in 1982.
Well, 1977, 78, 79, I was at Yale Drama School. You know, it's sequestered in the Ivy halls of Yale. And studying to be an actor. I returned to the day that I got my MFA, which is the Master of Fine Arts degree, but we called it the motherfucking actor degree. I came to New York. I literally left the graduation ceremony, came to New York, and had two auditions. One was to...
Don't you leave with an equity card?
You get your equity card. That's much more important than getting your diploma.
Right.
Because your equity card, of course, is the catch-22. You know, you can't get it unless, and you can't...
You can go right to work.
So we were able to go right to work. And I came in and auditioned. I had two auditions that day. One was to... There was a musical called Sweeney Todd playing on Broadway. Maybe you've heard of it.
Heard of it.
And Victor Garber, who was playing Anthony, the sailor, was leaving the show. And his understudy, Chris Gronendahl, was being promoted to replace him. And there was an audition to replace Chris Gronendahl in the understudy track and ensemble. I auditioned for that. And I auditioned for a musical called The 1940s Radio Hour, which was written and directed by somebody from Yale, not from the drama school, but a professor at Yale. And I had been in various formative stages of. I had those two auditions that day, and I got both jobs.
Wow.
And I thought it would be good to take the new show. I don't know what drugs I was on. I mean, I can't believe I turned down the chance to be in Sweeney Todd, but I did.
What is that?
It's fop, finest in the shop. And we have some shepherd's pie peppered with actual shepherd on top. And I've just begun. He's a politician so oily, he'll serve with a doily of one.
Put it on a bun. Well, you never know if it's going to run.
Try the fryer, fry the dryer.
No, the clergy is really too coarse and too mealy. Yes, and always arrives overdone. I'll come again when you have judge on the menu. Have charity towards the world, my pet.
Yes, yes, I know, my love.
We'll take the customers that we can get.
High born and low, my love.
We'll not discriminate great from small. No, we'll serve anyone, meaning anyone.
And then in September of 1979, I was fired from that show in previews and replaced. Not being in it enabled me to take the only acting job that I was offered, which was to go up and be a charter member of the American Repertory Theater in its premiere season and thereafter. And I attracted the attention of Peter Sellers, who had been a Harvard undergrad and was this sort of brilliant avant-garde opera director we've all heard of now. But he was going to direct at the ART, and he thought he liked my acting. So he cast me in everything he did. And so I spent two seasons up at the ART. This is with Cherry Jones and Mark Baker and Tony Shalhoub and Christine Nielsen and Carmen de Lavallade and Christopher Lloyd and Ken Ryan
it's a great group of actors.
Fantastic group of actors. The only one you've never heard of is me. Yeah. And
that's because you turned down Sweeney Todd.
They were so great. And then I was in a play directed by Lee Brewer.
Oh, sure.
Which was a consolidation of the three Vedekind plays about Lulu, the original femme fatale. And Joe Papp came and saw them and decided to bring them to New York. And, you know, of course, as a New Yorker growing up, red diaper baby like I was, Joe Papp was God.
Right.
And so Joe Papp was going to bring it to New York, so I left ART and came to New York. And that was when a dear friend of mine that I respected called and said, you have to go and see this thing that's playing on Broadway. It's The Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby. It's, this is an amazing thing. You have to go see it. It's going to change your life. And I said, the tickets are $100. I wouldn't pay $100. Are you kidding? I'm like, I'm a communist.
This
I would never, ever pay $100 to see a show. If I had $100, I would buy food.
Right.
And who are these Brits think they are coming here and sucking up all the oxygen? Fuck them. In fact, I was so fired up, I went to Equity and I started a committee to keep the British out of Broadway, or boob, as I called it. And I even had a t-shirt with the word boob across the front. This woman was so smart, and I respected her so much, that when she said, you have to go, my birthday's in November. So my parents asked me what I wanted for my birthday. I was 24 years old. And I said, I'd like $100 for food. And I got $100, and I went to the Plymouth Theater and got a ticket to see Nicholas Nickleby, which changed my life.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
The next day, after seeing Nicholas Nickleby all on a Saturday, 8.5 hours, I was doing a tap dance at a benefit for New York Stage and Film Company, founded by my friend Mark Lynn Baker and Leslie Erdang and Max Mayer. And at that benefit, I got a job offer to choreograph a show at the Astor Place Theater in the spring. So I choreographed this. It was, believe it or not, a jukebox musical, a Randy Newman jukebox musical.
There you go.
Foreshadowing.
They didn't call them jukebox musicals right. In those days.
They've always been around.
They're called reviews, aren't they?
Yeah. Jukebox musicals actually predate jukeboxes. So it's just a misnomer at the very, very least. You know, the great Irving Berlin, you know, Singing in the Rain, everybody's favorite movie musical. It's a jukebox musical. Get real, people. But, it's a little like, you know, to say all jukebox musicals are, you know, some sort of a boil on the ass of mankind is a little like walking into a museum and saying, oh God, not another rectangular painting. You know, like, who cares what the frame is, you know? What's inside the frame is
what matters.
We should argue about. The music director for this jukebox musical with songs by Randy Newman was working on a show across the street at the Public Theater for Joe Papp, written and directed by this Canadian genius named Des Makinoff, about the Red Baron. And David Bowie was going to play the Red Baron, and Jennifer Muller, the great avant-garde dance theater person, was doing the choreography, and everybody wanted to be in this show. And I went and auditioned, and I got in. And Joe Papp famously threw very sumptuous opening night parties for his actors, because he knew that otherwise we never ate.
Right.
And that was the night that I met Maddie Serino, and he and we were just talking literally online for the buffet, and he said, you seem like a funny guy. Do you think you could write funny headlines for me? And I said, no. I'm an actor. He said to me, I'll pay you $100. And I was making $149 a week as an actor in the show, plus an extra $20 because I was the dance captain, minus 10% because I had an agent, minus 50% because I had a government. And I saw $100. I said, I'll try to write funny headlines. I went walking down Broadway to 1515 Broadway, where Serino Coyne and Nappy had its offices. And I passed by the Winter Garden Theater, which was, you know, sort of always my lodestone, because Follies played there in 1971, and Follies was the show that changed my life. And I thought, oh, look, that stupid idiot Cats thing is, like, the box office. Look at all these idiots waiting online to buy tickets for this. Like, how, like, I, can you believe it? And then I went and found out that I was going to be working on that show.
Minutes later.
Life is funny.
Humility. Always humility. Kept asking me to come back, and I thought, well, he is paying me $100. You know, I guess I'll come back. At the end of the week, I said, you know, I can't come anymore because I have to be free for auditions. And he said, oh, all right. And he handed me a check for $500. He meant $100 a day. $100 a day. I mean, I thought I had.
It wasn't bad back then.
No. It's not bad now.
Yeah,
I mean, $100, I mean, cash, you know, like,
right.
I thought, oh my God. Do you need me to come back next week? So I came back a second week, and then at the end of the second week, he said, you don't need to come back because my partner, Nancy Coyne, is coming back. And then a few days later, I got a call from Nancy Coyne saying, my partner says you should come up, we should meet. And I did, and instantly we hit it off. We were kindred spirits from the very first moment. And she said, I need you to go to a dress rehearsal for a thing tonight because otherwise you'll never get a chance to see it because it's sold out for like a year. But you're going to be working on it, so you should go and look at it. And I said, what? She said, it's this Cats. It's at the Winter Garden. Here, take my intern, Hal Luftig.
Oh, my God.
And go and watch Cats tonight, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. And it just so happens that at Cats dress rehearsal, because he had just finished filming in Los Angeles the day before Bob Fosse's last movie called Star 80, mm-hmm. and was due to start rehearsals the next day in the West End for Tom Stoppard's new play, The Real Thing, Roger Rees decided, rather than fly from L.A. to London, which is a very long, tiring trip, to stop in New York and say hello to all his Nicholas Nickleby friends, Trevor Nunn, John Napier,
of course.
His old friend Gillian Lynn, who choreographed Comedy of Errors, which was the Olivier Award-winning best musical in 1977, you know, starring Roger and Judi Dench and Francesca Annis and Mike Williams. He decided to stop over in New York, and he came walking down the aisle to say hello to all his British pals. And I was sitting there in the aisle, and there was the guy that I had, like, fallen rapturously in love with a year before.
Hadn't you written him a letter?
I had done so many things. But I had also turned my little one-room apartment into a shrine to him. And there he was
in the flesh.
In the flesh. Right. And there was Hal Luftig, the intern, who said, oh, I know him. He used to teach us at Columbia last year when he was doing Nicholas Nickleby. I know him. And I said, okay, Hal, when this Cats thing is over, you're going to introduce me. And Hal did. Hal introduced me and Roger. We stood outside on 7th Avenue after Cats that night and talked until about 4 in the morning and never parted. But what was Broadway like, which was actually your question, it was... you know, the 70s were not kind to Broadway. And we lived through the Ford to New York Drop Dead. We lived through A Chorus Line changing everything and making it okay to come to Midtown Manhattan again. People forget that A Chorus Line wasn't just a hit show. And it wasn't just a sort of a major entertainment story like Hamilton, let's say. But it actually saved New York, because it made it okay to come back to the part of New York that nobody wanted to come to.
Again, step, kick, kick, knee, kick, touch. 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 Right. That connects with turn, turn, out, in, touch. Step, step, kick, kick, knee, kick, touch. Got it? Going on, and turn, turn, touch, down, back step, pivot step, walk, 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 right. Let's do the whole combination, facing away from the mirror, from the top, a 5, 6, 7, 8.
How many people does he need?
How many people does he need?
I hope I get it. I hope
people, and all the people. How many people does he need? How many boys, how many girls, how many people does he?
I really need this job. Please, God, I need this job. I've got to get this job.
Broadway was revising itself, and it was, as of 1979, 1980, 1981, it was kind of becoming a destination for great British theater. Mm. You know, those were the things that got the carriage trade, as it used to be called, people with money, to come back to those few blocks in Midtown Manhattan at a time of day when people would really not want to be there. But Broadway was, I was the 13th hire at Sereno Coyne in 1982.
Which went on to become the largest advertising agency.
It was a great big advertising agency that had all the business. And every
Was that
Sunday,
J. Walter Thompson?
No, J. Walter Thompson had already split into Ashladon, Sereno Coyne, and Nappy. But Ashladon had the lion's share of the business.
Right. And then that became LaDon Wilner, right?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And every Sunday...
That's not when I came to New York.
Every Sunday, as I'm sure Peter LaDon and John Wilner did, Nancy and Matthew and Nick Nappy and I would sit with the Arts and Leisure section. The Sunday Arts and Leisure section is published on Wednesday. So we would get it up on Wednesday, and we would sit with the ABCs, and we would mark off the shows that we had and mark off the shows that they had. And gradually, over the next couple of years, we saw the balance shift until we were like we were the top dog, and it was very exciting to be in at the ground floor of something that was happening. Nancy sort of invented the idea of theater marketing. There was no theater marketing.
None at all. And I remember the first time I walked into the hallowed halls of Sereno Coyne in 1996 to work on my first Broadway show. And I will never forget walking into reception and the wall of window cards that represented the current running shows. It wasn't even a history wall.
Oh, no.
It was just the 20 shows that were currently running or whatever the number was. And it was a breathtaking for this, younger me. It was a very intimidating and incredible thing.
What show was that you were doing?
You weren't on it, I don't think. It was called Street Corner Symphony.
Street Corner Symphony. Ken Waisman.
I was on it,
but I was sort of in a supervisory capacity. I worked on 307 musicals.
Over
my years at Sereno, and about half as many plays. And that's why I'm so irritating now to most of the people that I work with, because they go, I worked on that.
Yesterday, I watched the documentary Moon Over Broadway.
That's right.
And
I think I'm in it.
You are in it. Well, that's the point. It gets to the point where they're doing
So is a dentist.
The next day, ad meeting, and they cut to the conference room and that massive wood table. And all of a sudden, I start hearing you reading the ad copy.
Carol Burnett came to the dress rehearsal of the Cher show in Chicago because she just happened to be passing through town, and Mackie invited her. And there's like 50 people and Joan Marcus in the audience.
That's the rule.
And Joan is snapping away, and Bob brings down Carol Burnett. So he introduces her to a few people, and he introduces her to me, and she said hello. And I said, believe it or not, we met years and years ago on Moon Over Buffalo. And I'll tell you, just as a little sidebar, something that makes a star. There was an early preview, maybe the very first preview, I can't remember, of Moon Over Buffalo at the aforementioned Martin Beck, now Al Hirschfeld Theater. And it was a great big Heidi Landisman set. And something didn't work. And they had to stop the performance. And I was in the audience. And the stage manager came on and said, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to stop for a moment. And the moment became a minute, and then 5 minutes, and then 10 minutes. And I thought, what the hell is going on? So I went through the pass-through door backstage, and there was a major technical problem involving some hydraulic something or other. And Carol Burnett, who was starring in the show, said, well, okay, here's what we're going to do. Nobody knew what to do. And Carol Burnett said, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go out, and I'm going to do, like, questions, like I've done on my show. The audience will, it'll make the audience very, very happy. So the stage manager said, okay, great. I'll raise the curtain. She goes, no, you're not going to raise the curtain. What do you mean? Well, how are you going to get out? She said, you're going to raise the curtain 2 feet, exactly 2 feet. He said, no, I can raise it. She said, no, I know you can raise it all the way. I want you to raise it 2 feet. Okay. So he raises the curtain 2 feet. I go back out through the pass door, and I'm now standing at the back of the theater. See 2 feet, and then you see these two skinny legs. And then Carol Burnett got down on the floor and rolled out from under the curtain and stood up. And the audience went, before she even said a word, the audience went berserk. Because she, coming from the theater, knew exactly how to make the audience completely forget that they were being delayed, and it was you know, like one of like the five great theater moments of my life, and it wasn't even a theater moment. It was just that one night where she saved the day times a million because she knew exactly what to do, and everyone backstage had no idea what she was talking about. That was thrilling.
What is the number one greatest theater moment of your life?
Yeah.
I think when I was 15 years old, and I say 15 because, like, the year before I had been to see, I had a theater friend who became a very famous and then infamous press agent named Fred Nathan. He knew about the Drama Bookshop, and he was able to get scripts for Broadway shows. And he introduced me to the item called the vocal score, which wasn't the stupid piano selections that you could get anywhere, but it was actually every note of music that was played in a show reduced to something that I could play on the piano. Well, I mean, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. And we used to reenact these Broadway shows, playing all the parts ourselves on Saturday afternoons. Then when we got a little bit older, which is, say, 14.
Right.
He said, come on, let's go to see this new show called Company. And we went to see Company, and I thought, what the hell is this about? I don't understand. It's just these boring middle-aged people talking about marriage. Who cares? You know, I was 14. A year later, I think I probably had finally reached puberty. And we came down into Broadway to try to see Applause, and it was sold out. It was a Saturday afternoon. It was sold out. He said, well, let's go to see this other show called Follies. And I said, oh, no, I can't. He said, why? I said, well, my parents saw it, and they forbid me to see it. He said, well, how are they ever going to know? And I thought, oh, yeah, how would they ever know? We went to see the show I was forbidden to see, and I was 15, and I had never seen anything like it in my life. I didn't even know what I was seeing, but I knew that it was astonishing.
Say, Mr. Producer, yeah, I'm talking to you, sir. I don't need a lot, only what I've got. Plus a tube of grease paint and I'll follow.
Mr. Broadway, baby. If I stick it long enough, I may get to strut my stuff. Working for an Iceman like a Ziegfeld or a Weissman in a great big Broadway show.
What I did know was I had to go back and see it again. Now, you know, repetition disorder wasn't a term then, and there was no technology that enabled you to see things that you wanted to see whenever you wanted to see them. You know, if you wanted to see an old movie, you would catch it on the Million Dollar Movie, if it or not.
Right.
You know, it was a very, very different world. And we were not a wealthy family, and the idea of going to see something twice was anathema. I had never, ever done it. And here I was desiring to see something twice that I had been forbidden to see even once. So I was shitting myself, but I went and got it was a matinee, so the box office still opened at the end. And I went up and got a ticket to see it again the following Saturday. And I went 52 Saturdays in a row. Here's how devious I was. I put all my ticket stubs in a rubber band inside my desk. So, of course, my mother, who, you know, frequently would search through my drawers to find out what drugs I was on, found 52 stubs for Follies, a show I was forbidden to see even once.
52.
But that took a long, long time. I became obsessed with that show. Not thinking it was the greatest show, but thinking that it was the greatest experience for me. And it sort of took over my life. And that was 1971 into July of 1972. When it closed at the Winter Garden and moved and opened the Schubert Theater in Los Angeles.
In L.A., yeah. So wait, you weren't even going to see Bacall and Applause. You were going to see Ann Baxter?
Arlene Dahl.
Oh, Arlene Dahl? Not even Ann Baxter.
Arlene fucking Dahl.
Wow. Well,
couldn't get in.
But right. I think
it worked out. Yeah.
There's a force guiding
you. I
missed
you. Arlene Dahl, but I found Alexis Smith.
Well, right. There was no one better than Alexis Smith. I think you've just answered our final question that we ask everyone.
That's right. You've answered it multiple times,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, I think you've asked. So now I'm going to ask, the question we always ask is the final question is, what was that show that made you want to work in the theater or that changed your life? Is it My Fair Lady? Is it Follies? Is it Company? Sounds like it's Follies. Or is there a
I thought it was Follies, but I have to say that, I mean, there are like, it's a handful of things. I have to say that I thought it was Follies, and then the same Fred Nathan called me when I was in college and said, Michael Bennett, who to me was a god because of Follies, Michael Bennett's doing this new thing about dancers, and you have to come see it. It's at the Public Theater. Well, you know, anything to do with Joe Papp, I was there.
Right.
I drove down from Cornell, and I met Fred at the Newman Theater, and we saw A Chorus Line in preview.
Wow.
Cassie didn't get the job.
Play me the music. Play me the music. Play me the music. Give me a chance to come through. All I ever needed was the music and the mirror and the chance to dance.
Then Via Sereno in 83, 84, working on Dreamgirls, 85, 86, working on Scandal, Chess. I got to know Michael quite well before he died. I had that experience. I had Michael Bennett perform a show for me in his home while I just sat there looking like a schmuck, you know. And So there was A Chorus Line. There was also, I have to say, in all fairness, on March 4th, 1979, Sweeney Todd opened at the now Gershwin Theater You know, when you're in the presence of a masterpiece, you know that it's a masterpiece, and it was a masterpiece. And that was 1979. And then, thanks to my friend now, the great actress Caitlin Clark, no longer alive, I went to see, on December 5th, 1981, Nicholas Nickleby, which is, I think, it's probably safe to say that for anyone who saw it, it was a singular theater experience. And it was life-changing because it, not because it was Dickens, although Dickens is wonderful, and not because Roger was in it, although Roger was in it, was the center of it. But that the poor theater, story theater technique that Trevor and John Caird imbued in that production and made the lifeblood of that production was exactly the kind of theater that I grew up loving and fell in love with again at Yale and wanted to devote my life to. So for me, it was sort of a recapitulation of everything that I cared about and loved, felt passionately about in terms of theater. And I felt like, yeah, they're British, but God damn it, they really got it right. But Nicholas Nickleby was a summation, really, like a valedictory of everything that I had grown up and studied and loved about what theater could be, where money wasn't the solution, but imagination was the solution, and storytelling was the solution. And it was profound. And I think, after that, there was, yes, seeing Roger and Felicity Kendall in The Real Thing, the most, I think, in London, it was the most romantic thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I think, had it been another Stoppard play, because historically they used to give me toothaches because he's so brilliant, and like all I did was feel like an idiot. But The Real Thing was so romantic that if it hadn't been as great, I would never have ended up with Roger because we wouldn't have had anything to talk about. You know, what are you going to say if somebody's in something you don't like? You just quickly change the subject. But I was able to go on and on and on about it. Of course, there was that. Angels in America. I mean, when I was thinking about leaving advertising, suddenly Angels in America came along. When I was thinking about leaving advertising again, suddenly Lion King came along. Rent a couple of years before that, too. When I thought I could never get out of the house, Lin Miranda, very sweetly, because he's the dearest man in the world, didn't really know me and didn't know Roger at all, sent me a ticket for opening night to Hamilton because he knew that I was sad. And when Cher said, "I bet you haven't been out of the house," she was right, except the only night that I'd been out of the house was opening night of Hamilton, which I went to because I got a ticket from Lin Miranda. And, you know, so it's a handful of things.
It's not just
I think
one.
It's okay that it's not one thing, that it's a handful of things. But what those handful of things have in common is some idea of making me thank God for the day I was born. You know, I think it was maybe Noel Coward, or maybe it's apocryphal, but, you know, he said, great theater should always make you thank God for the day you were born. And if you don't know what that means, if you think that that's a silly statement, then, you know, God bless you. I hope you come to the theater. But it means that you don't really understand what the theater means to those of us who understand what that means. When you actually thank God for the day you were born, when the hair stands up on the back of your neck, there we are. We're this tribe of people who have this art form that represents us, and those moments have all made me feel that. The end.
Thank you very much. That was beautiful how you said that. And I think on that note, we should just leave it there. Thank you so much for coming down and joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for my penne pasta. It's a pleasure. And yes, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome to the theater, to the magic, to the fun, where painted trees and flowers grow and laughter rings fortissimo and treachery sweetly done. Now you've entered the asylum, this profession unique, are children playing hide and ego seek.
Hi, it's Jamie. That's our show. Thanks for listening. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman. Find us on iTunes and online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid. And tune in next Wednesday.
Welcome to the theater. My dear, you'll love it so. Welcome to the dirty concrete hallways. Welcome to the friendly roaches, too. Welcome to the pinchers from the stagehands. It's the only quiet thing they do. Welcome to the Philadelphia critics. Welcome, Librium and Nebutol. Welcome to a life of laryngitis. Welcome to dark toilets in the hall. Welcome to the flop you thought would run for years. Welcome to the world of fears and cheers and tears. Welcome to the theater with some luck. You'll be a pro. You'll work and slave and scratch and bite. You'll learn to kill with sheer delight. You'll only come alive at night when you're in a show. Welcome to the theater, you fool. You love it so.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.